Well, Charlie's ready.
Hey, you remember how I was playing with the cue points when we were setting up the call? I forgot to put it back where it was supposed to be. This is Pure Decking for April the 19th, 1775. The show about stuff that interests me. I'm Morps. Tonight we got Analog, BSV, and Suave. Not that I have ever claimed to know what the hell I'm doing with a soundboard.
Have any of us claimed to know what the hell we're doing?
RU did once, yes. But it didn't end well.
I always know what I'm doing.
Are you sure about that?
I always expect something heard to happen. Why isn't something heard happening?
I don't know.
I always know what I'm doing,
at least. Whether or not it's good, that's a different story. But I always know what I'm doing.
I always know what I'm doing. I'm pressing this button. Oh, wait, that wasn't good. Anyways. Okay. So just a little quick note on station news. Between the Sheets went on hiatus. So we're not going to get into the details on that. Just know that it, Syntax actually has a good reason or two. So, yeah, one of which involves massive amounts of medication. So I forgot to think of a goofy question to open the show with. What are you guys doing? So.
Well, technically, they both could involve massive amounts of medication.
When isn't massive amounts of medication not fun?
Well, I don't know if it's the kind that makes you hallucinate like your face is melting. Or the kind where people, you know, rip off their own arms.
Still could be fun.
Well, you rip your arms off and let us know how that goes for you.
I'm pretty sure at the time it's fun. It's the after effects that may not be fun.
Yeah, the whole bleeding to death thing. So, all right. Well, we're obviously failing at witty banter this morning. So, and I just said this morning. Wow, it's been a day. It has been a fucking day. I tell you what. All right, first story is from ThreatPost. The head of Google's web spam team says that the company has pushed warning messages to some 20,000 website owners that their site may be compromised and are performing weird redirections, possibly to malicious websites. Matt Cutts used a Twitter message on Tuesday to announce that the company sent "You might be hacked" messages to sites, which are in dozens of different languages, and notices from the company's search quality team are visible on websites in question, and warn webmasters that their site may be hacked and that JavaScript may have been inserted in the page to redirect users to malicious sites. You should check your source code for any unfamiliar JavaScript, in particular any files containing eval function, you know, P-A-K or P-A-C-K-E-R, packer. Yeah, that eval function thing, that's very commonly used to hide JavaScript, so when you're scanning the code, you can't tell what it does. The malicious code may be placed in HTML, JavaScript, or PHP files, so it's important to be thorough in your search, Google warns. A search turned up only a handful of non-English websites displaying the warning text, though Cutts said that 20,000 webmasters received the notice. This is not the first time Google has taken action to weed out compromised websites from those that may turn up in search results. In July 2011, the company removed websites hosted on .co.cc free web hosting service from its search results, saying that because a large percentage of these sites on free hosting provider are low quality or spammy. That means Google, if Google thinks your site's a low quality, they're pulling it out of the
spammy.
Spammy. That's a word, apparently. Studies have shown that despite the company's best efforts, malicious and suspicious websites are often able to use search engine optimization to slip past Google's filters and wind up on the search results lists, and that the search engine giant flags only half of all the malicious. How do they know that? Malicious sites rendered by its search engine. How do you know they're only getting half? I mean, it's like, oh, well, we got to skip that half. So,
it's a big company. It's just like how other companies know how much money you're ripping them off for copying stuff. Pick a random number.
That's a good answer. Actually, I think it's kind of cool. Go ahead, Alan.
I was going to say, so they're relating this these websites to spam, because spammy is an adjective having the qualities and likeness of spam.
Yes, that's right. It's in a can. It might be meat, and it's covered in a weird gel. So, oh wait, that's probably not what they mean.
And it's not too bad fried.
But actually, I think it's kind of cool because Google is going around indexing sites. It's kind of not a bad idea to have their robots look for obvious things like, you know, JavaScript and strange looking iframes and, you know, executables showing up on their bot machines. It's like, this website's not doing things correctly. We should we should maybe make a note of that.
Well, just building on what you said there, you know, Google is really in a unique position to get this sort of data because, like, they probably have more information on internet traffic than any other company on the planet. Because, you know, like, they're not dealing with just one country or anything like that or even one geographic region. They're covering the entire planet.
Yep.
And, I think, you know, like, they shouldn't be obliged to provide that sort of service, but I think
it's good to
go. Yeah, it goes a long way in the, you know, whole don't be evil mindset.
Well, you know, the only thing is they're specifically blocking these sites and their search results, and I'm not sure how I quite feel about that aspect of it, but the fact that they're you know, noticing and notifying, that's cool. Like, if somebody goes to the G15 site and you get a pop-up for something or it tries to install something, I'd like to know about it so I can clean it up because it shouldn't do that.
Oh, absolutely. So, and, you know, as far as their blocking of sites, you know, I think it's probably they're probably doing what they did with, you know, when there's a malicious site, they don't actually block it. Don't they just say, oh, well, this site contains malicious code or whatever?
It depends. In later versions of Firefox and Chrome, especially the ones that use the Google Site Advisor, it can be extraordinarily difficult to even get the browser to go to the site. You'll keep getting redirected back to that warning page. Now, it's actually not that difficult to just go into the browser and turn off the site advisor to do what you need to do. Like, I was trying to do malware analysis on a page where at work we had a web page get popped and was redirecting people to another page. So I was trying to do analysis on that page to figure out what the malware was. Turns out it was already broken. Whoever had set it up hadn't done a very good job. So all it really did was screw up the web page, the original web page. It didn't actually do anything to our clients, which was good. But because it kept redirecting to that Google block page saying, hey, this thing's potentially malicious, it actually looked like our site was blocked by Google, and it wasn't. But I actually had to turn Site Advisor off to figure that out. So, anyways, kudos to Google for at least, you know, figuring out that they are in a good position to do that.
Absolutely. Yep.
All right, next one up. This one's from Hacker News. This is kind of fun. Security researchers from Trend Micro, Essecure, and Dr. Web have intercepted two new ransomware variants currently circulating in the wild. The new ransomware variant prevents infected computers from loading Windows by replacing their master boot record and displaying a message asking users for money. Yeah, Chris Pantanilla, am I saying that name right? Pantanilla? I don't know. A threat response engineer at Trend Micro said, based on our analysis, this malware copies the original MBR and overwrites it with its own malicious code. Right after performing this routine, it automatically restarts the system for the infection to take place. The MBR is a piece of code that resides in the first sectors of the hard drive, blah, 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 blah. Okay, the MBR is what loads Windows, essentially. It's what you install grub in if you install Linux. Both F-Secure and Dr. Web have intercepted identical ransomware variant, and upon execution, encrypts all files by adding a .dot. It's got enciphered file extension. It's written out in kind of a, you know, GeoCities messed up caps, you know, bad spelling ish. End users are given the option to have 5 attempts to try and enter the unlock code in between the malware deletes itself and leaves the files encrypted. Oh, that kind of sucks. the ransomware displays the following message to infected users. Attention, all your files are encrypted. You are using unlicensed programs. To restore your files and access them, send code UCRASH or pay save card, nominal value of €50. I love the way this is written. To the email address cosurg@gmail.com. You have 5 attempts to enter the code. If you exceed this, all of your data irrevocably spoiled. Be careful when you enter te code. Repairing the malware.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's safe to say this is not coming from an English speaker.
No, but I'm just I hope I did that justice by reading it that way. Repairing the MBR is no trivial matter and usually requires booting from the Windows installation disk, getting into the recovery console, and typing special commands. It's not that fucking hard. Ransomware infections are typically more common throughout Eastern Europe and South America, but this type of malware is slowly gaining traction in other regions of the world. Where? Okay, so what it didn't actually define it in the article. What ransomware is where a virus or a Trojan somehow renders your computer unusable and then claims if you send them money, generally via credit card, they will, you know, give you access to your computer back. You know, it's, you know, taking your computer hostage and holding it for ransom, hence ransomware. And these particular ones are the first time they've seen them dicking around with the MBR, which is, as I explained earlier, what loads when you turn the computer on. The BIOS reads the MBR and then follows whatever instructions are there. So that's where the little program that tells Windows to start up or tells Linux to start up lives. Now, repairing an MBR on Windows isn't so hard. It's you do boot off the installation disk and go into the recovery console and just do /fix MBR. That's the command, fix MBR. It's not that hard. I've had to do it several times. It's also how you uninstall Grub if you just delete the Linux partition and don't want to screw up Windows. You just restore the Windows MBR. What'd you say, Analog?
I said I've done that one before.
Yeah, it's not that big a deal. Now, the one that encrypts out your files, that's a bit of a problem. So, but
yeah, definitely a particularly nasty one, because this is not something that most people are going to know how to do anything about.
Oh, no. At that point, your best bet is just to format the computer and start over. Because even if you send these Yahoos your credit card information, you think they're only going to charge you the $50, and you think they're actually going to send you the unlock code?
Yeah. Well, at least these people are play enough to send pretty much a prepaid card is, I think, what the two cards are. So these people aren't actually quite as evil.
If you can actually understand their directions.
That too.
That's why it's only being done in Eastern Europe and South America.
Yeah. And also you have to hope that they are somewhat decent that they actually spell the password correctly.
Well, from what I understand, what most ransomware does when you pay for it, it's the same thing with like the fake antivirus, right? You pay for it on your credit card, and the company that did it's only going to take whatever you charged, but they know that credit card's good, so that credit card's immediately going on the black market, and they may or may not give you the code. Some ransomware places do, some don't. They don't care. They've got what they want. They've got your money. They're done. They're moving on to the next.
That's why you give them somebody else's credit card off of off Google.
That's easy enough to. The sad part is that's easy enough to do. Site, paste, bin, yeah. Visa. There it is. Yeah, don't actually use Visa cards off paste, bin, post. I'm sure most of those are tracked by the FBI fairly quickly. If you want to get caught, I mean. Anyways, so let's see. Okay, this is cool. Go ahead. Go ahead, Swift.
I was just going to say, there's actually a similar variant of that out there that also encrypts, says they encrypt your files and then say, send money through MoneyPack or Ucash. But what they say is that there's a bunch of kiddie porn on your computer. And in order to protect everybody, they've encrypted your files. And in order to clean your system, you have to send them. These guys, they actually want a little bit more, $500.
Oh, damn.
To get the kiddie porn off of your computer. But, you know, this is probably a lot more effective because, like.
That's a good threat tactic right there.
Well, yeah. Like, if they say, oh, it's just infected, well, that's fine. But, if there's kiddie porn on there, well, you might go to jail. You don't want to go to jail.
Well, if I got that one in from a ransomware, the computer would just disintegrate in a massive fireball.
Yeah. It's like, wow, well, check out how fast I can get the gasoline. And but Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking too. It's like, how many people pay the $500 and how many people throw the computer in the garbage compactor? I mean, so, or at least just deband the hard drive a couple hundred times. So, anyways, moving on. This one's cool. This is from tech.ly, or LI. There's an extension there. A noted BitTorrent file sharing site, The Pirate Bay, has launched an ongoing promotional contest in which independent musicians, filmmakers, comedians, and artists can submit their work in an effort to be featured on the site's front page. And according to the site's creators, more than 5,000 artists have submitted their work. The contest will be called The Promo Bay, because these guys are quite noted for their unique naming conventions. As you might have seen, we sometimes replace our front page logo with others. Reads the site. Sometimes we link to important political issues like internet censorship, and sometimes it's cool to indie musicians we like. We would like to now improve this feature. Creators who submit their work will be able to choose which countries they would rather their work be featured in, though the site says that we find your stuff mind-blowing and we might post it worldwide. But the site is worded as not to raise the hopes of middling artists. Of course, we can and will not release everything we receive, reads the site. We will pick something every now and again from the pool. It's not clear how or if the Pirate Bay plans to verify the content was submitted by its actual creator, though it's hard to imagine independent artists turning down the publicity of a direct link to the site for non-political reasons. The promotional site could be seen as a strategic move by the Pirate Bay to strengthen its image as a neutral or beneficial force to independent artists, in contrast to the destructive picture painted by the Industry Trade Associates. I need to drink. I'm having a hell of a time reading these stories tonight. So, okay, blah, 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 blah. It goes on about the Pirate Bay. Essentially, the Pirate Bay is asking for independent artists to send them their work, and they'll feature it on the front page if they like it.
I think that's actually a really good idea, and they really need to be moving in that direction. Just absolutely. Because, you know, they've been demonized so much that they really need to put an image out of them actually, like, you know, working for independent media and stuff like that. Well, if they actually get that image out there, it's going to be a lot more difficult to shut them down because they actually have a legitimate use. Yeah, now, yes, we all know that they already have a legitimate use. It's just this isn't part of their mainstream image.
Yeah, because it helped Mega upload so much to, you know, host, you know, actual content. But you know, they keep looking for ways to shut the Pirate Bay down, and the Pirate Bay just keeps kind of laughing at them. So I'm not so much worried about that aspect of it. But if you ever go hunt around the Pirate Bay, there is a lot of independent and Creative Commons content on there, you know, besides all the piracy. So I, you know, it's a platform. It's just like anything else. And I think it's really cool that they're going to focus on some of these independent guys, because I don't know about you guys, but here lately, the independent stuff's been a hell of a lot better than the mass media.
Yeah.
So. All right.
Yeah. I was just going to say, you know, you go for the mass media, Justin Bieber, and you're going to be having a bad time.
Thank you, South Park ski instructor. So, let's see. All right, this next one up is from Torrent Freak, and this is not so good. A dispute over whether a Swedish ISP can be forced to hand over the details of one of its subscribers to an anti-piracy group has just received its long-awaited ruling from Europe's highest court. A few moments ago, the ECJ announced that there are no EU barriers which prevent the ISP from handing over its customers' private details to copyright holders. Not long after Sweden's controversial iPred legislation became law in 2009, five book publishers handed a request for information to a local court. The rights holders, represented by anti-piracy group Antipirabran, I don't speak Swedish, if anybody else wants to take a stab at that there. Antipirabran? I don't know. Wanted to force local ISP ePhone to hand over the personal details of a subscriber who allegedly stored more than 2,000 audiobooks on his server, 27 of which breached copyright or breached a publisher's copyrights. I am really struggling tonight, I tell you guys what. In June that year, the court ordered ePhone to provide information, but the ISP felt it wrong to comply and instead took their case to Court of Appeal. The ruling of the lower court was overturned on appeal, and the case was sent to Sweden's highest court. In the event, even the Supreme Court couldn't decide, Intern forwarded the case to the European Court of Justice. A few moments ago, the ECJ, if I could read, ECJ, released its decision, one that is sure to please rights holders. The ECJ decided that there are no EU barriers which stop ePhone from being ordered to provide the information as requested by Antti Pyrbron and the book publishers. The court said that Swedish law strikes an appropriate balance between the rights of copyright holders and the citizens' rights to privacy. And I'm going to stop there. Yeah. So,
I'm totally okay with ISPs giving out information to law enforcement agencies. Yeah. If somebody's breaking the law and it can be proven that this person's breaking the law, sure, I agree that they should be able to give out that information. But to the copyright holders, that's kind of a little scary. Bit sketchy. Especially, let's say you have a guy who wrote a song. It's not highly published, but, it's copyrighted, right? He's a little bit nuts, but, that's okay. He's the copyright holder. And you take his song and you go put it out on the internet and gets hundreds and thousands of views. And this guy all of a sudden feels like you've trodden on him. And he's going to go try to shoot you. This is easy because now I can just go to the ISP, get your home address, and I can just show up at your door.
Well, that's a little bit of a contrived situation. How about we try one?
No, this is totally realistic. It happened just the other day. No, it didn't.
What? Okay.
Stop making up news again.
Yeah, that's Heavy's job. Let's try this again. A little bit less contrived of a scenario. We've actually had stories where a copyright group decided they owned somebody else's music. How often does that? I mean, that's one of the reasons I don't want to post most of my stuff on YouTube. Is I'll have somebody else come along and claim copyright on your video because it's got birds chirping in the background or some other BS. Or I think there was one that was uploading or claiming they own sections of Silence just to get their banner ads up on these videos, right? So you think this isn't going to be abused? If you've got somebody out there saying, I don't know, bad-mouthing the RIAA, like, say, I do. You think they're not going to go to the ISPs and be like, yeah, this person, they were sharing Justin Bieber or whatever. We need their name. And, so now I've got them harassing me because I've said something they don't like. This is not, there's the copyright issue of it, but I think there's going to be a chilling effect on just straight up free speech if you can be harassed by a corp just because, you say something they don't like or you post up media they don't like or you're posting media that competes with theirs.
Again,
yeah,
law should not be enforced by corporate copyright companies.
It's not good. This is not a good decision, especially because it wasn't just one country. This was didn't you say it was the European Court of Appeals?
It's a Swedish case, but because the Swedish courts couldn't figure it out, they sent it up to the European Court of Justice, which apparently is one of the highest courts in Europe.
Right, so this is going to have far-reaching implications, not just for Sweden.
No, it's going to be for the EU and any companies that any countries that might take a lead from the EU as far as setting their precedent and their law.
Yeah.
So, that's going to be problematic. So let's go on to a funny one. This one's also from Hacker News. The FBI swooped in on Hajime Ochima. The third, after he posted the snap, which included a gloating message to his online victims, he took the picture on his iPhone and posted it on Twitter without realizing that it contained GPS data pointing directly to his house. Researching the username Wormer, investigators found a reference online which included Ocha's full name. Ocha is an alleged member of Cabin Crew, an offshoot of the hacktivist collective Anonymous. There any hacker group's now going to be an offshoot of Anonymous. Just remember that when you're reporting. A criminal complaint filed in connection with the case revealed that pictures of an amply proportioned young woman taken in an outer Melbourne suburb played a key role in the case. The snap posted by 30-year-old Olcha shows a girl in a bikini top from the neck down with a printed message pinned to her shirt reading "Pwned by Wormer and Cabin Crew." The GPS location allowed the police to easily track down the presumed residence of the woman pictured in the photo, believed to be Ocha's Australian girlfriend, and others like it in similar vein promoting Anonymous. One of these featured a picture of the same woman alongside a sign saying "Come at me, bro" at and on Wormer hashtag cabin crew. So in other words, this dude was posting pictures of his girlfriend's tits to gloat about his hacks. And he didn't realize that the metadata that the iPhone attaches to the pictures, namely GPS data, told the cops right where he was.
Mm. And
this just makes my brain hurt.
Yeah. Also, apparently they just had to search Wormer and they got his full name from that.
Yeah, he wasn't doing that great of a job.
If you're going to have an online name completely separated from your real one, if you're gonna do something stupid.
Anything done online is stupid. So just as a good rule of thumb, try not to mix them up. But I just was laughing so hard at the idea that this dude got caught because he was posting pictures of his girlfriend's tits.
Oh yeah. Oh, I was actually gonna say. Well, besides, hackers don't use iPhones, but that might piss some people off here.
Oh no, they certainly do. They jailbreak them. And most of the ones who do realize there's metadata in those pictures. Yeah. But when playing around with some of the tools that read metadata, Mephit, when he posts on Twitter, he uses his phone to do it and it posts his GPS location. I don't know if he knows that or not. But I'm pretty sure I had the route he takes to and from work every day when I was playing with that tool.
That's amazing.
Of course, I haven't talked to Mephit in forever, so that was a while back, guys. So I don't know how accurate that stuff is today. So, and I didn't actually save it, but yeah, no, his Twitter was like really easy to figure out. So if you wanted to freak him out, somebody who lives closer to him, like say BSV, just show up.
Yeah, right.
But
I'm pretty sure just showing up to most people in our group would end up badly unannounced.
He's got a point.
Yeah, that's true. He might get a point. That would be the bad joke. Sorry. Actually, I've got so many pictures I take with my phone. I really, really need to be careful about that because I need to. I used to have a program that it would actually scrub all the metadata out of a picture, and I've
really good idea.
Misplaced it, but it's easy to find.
And you know what really very well could have happened was. He knew about the metadata at some point in the past, and either just forgot or was lazy and didn't bother.
Oh, sure. That happens all the time. So.
Yeah. That story actually reminds me, there's another story that happened this week about a guy who was over in British Columbia, up here in Canada. He has had some videos of himself driving a motorcycle down the highway at 300 kilometers an hour. And the cops didn't like this very much, so the guy he posted this up on YouTube, they contacted YouTube. They're like, "Yeah, this is the guy's IP address," and then he got busted. And of course, he did not have a driver's license, and his bike was not insured, so he's probably going to jail.
Yeah, and he provided the evidence for them. How convenient.
Yep.
So, all right, next story. This one's back to Torrent Freak again. When copyright trolls speak, they usually do so only through their lawyers. For the driving force behind the new wave of anti-BitTorrent settlement letters about to hit the UK, things are a little different. Out goes the stuffy legal jargon, and in comes the basics. BitTorrent users are tight, and the upcoming campaign is about making even more money. Last month, the UK High Court gave UK pornographer Lindsay Honey, a.k.a. Ben Dover... Wait a minute. Must be a company name. And his company, GoldenEye International, a provisional green light to obtain the identities of thousands of alleged file sharers from ISP02. It's now a well-trodden path. Send out scary letters to alleged copyright infringers and ask for money to make mostly imaginary court cases go away. I love the way Torrent Freak writes. This controversial business is almost always concluded with a law firm front end or law firm front and center, who spend much of their public-facing time throwing around legal jargon and talking endlessly about infringed rights. But Lindsay Honey, who became famous in the UK for his Gonzo-style movies, which placed himself at the center of the action, seems to want to keep it real by continuing the tradition of doing his own dirty work. And that includes speaking publicly about his latest attempt at monetizing porn. In an interview with Vice.com, Honey explained that due to everything on the internet being free, his income dropped by 90% in 2 years. This development didn't go unnoticed by Revenue and Customs, who apparently thought something underhanded might be going on in Honey's tax affairs. While noting that he assured them it wasn't the case, Honey is clear about his motives for entering the speculative invoicing market. Oh my God, that's a term. Speculative invoicing. I like it. At the end of the day, if I can't make money out of porn, the only way I can make money is to get people who are not buying it. I need to earn a living. I'm not a charity. So what he's saying here is he's absolutely trying to get people to pay up through settlement letters to make money. So at least he's owning up to it. Everyone's in stunned silence.
Yeah. Sorry, I was actually muted. You know, this is nothing new. People have been doing this long before there was even the internet. He's just, like you said, owning up to it, which is, you know, that's fine. Good luck to him. It's probably not going to be very successful.
Well, I think Torrent Freak makes a point that for the most part, these kind of infringement cases are imaginary. They very rarely ever go to court.
What people should be doing actually is disseminating information out there for the public to be aware of these types of things. Because, like, generally, if you fight it, they'll just drop the case. They don't really want to go to court.
No, it's more expensive for them to fight it for the, you know, whatever the settlement value is. At least in places like the UK and the US, because we've got a statutory damages where the number's kind of ridiculously high, it might still be worth it to take them to court over, you know, a handful of songs or movies.
Yeah.
So,
I think up here in Canada, they put a limit on it. The absolute maximum they can sue you for is $5,000, which is still a fair chunk of change.
Yeah, but I bet
not
those
like $42 million.
Yeah, I'm willing to bet most of those claims went away. Well, hell, when the RIAA sued LimeWire, they were suing them for more money than exists on the planet. So.
Yeah.
I'm serious. It was like $10 trillion more than the world's combined GDP. And remember, the judge threw it out because it was like, this is ridiculous. So
what year did this Lindsay get her sex change?
I'm not sure. That's a weird name. I think it's a guy.
Well, I mean, you have Lindsay Honey, a.k.a. Bend Over.
Yeah. Oh, and I didn't catch that.
You didn't even catch it, did you?
I didn't catch Bend Over. No, I didn't catch that. I'm sorry. I'm just
so apparently. Lindsay likes to bend over and take the golden eye.
Must be. I don't know, but it's. You know, we'll have to ask Syntax when he comes back around about that name, because I don't get it. Yeah,
I don't even want to get it. But anyways,
yeah, I'm yeah. Anyways, just another quick one. This one's from Sophos. There's another Mac Trojan. This one puts in a plist file in your preferences, and it drops a couple of plist files in your user library launch agent's preferences and in your Apple.com. It has the ability to upload and download files, as well as run arbitrary commands and take a screenshot. Most infections are installed without user intervention due to the abuse of EXP, and they've got a number of the exploit, which was only patched on OS X several weeks after a patch was available for other operating systems. I think it's the same Java vulnerability. And also, they make a point that their tool is not managing to reach into the Time Machine backups and clean it up, so you'll have to do that by hand. So, pretty soon, this isn't going to be a deal, but that's like the second or third OS X Trojan in the past couple of weeks, so it's worth pointing them out.
The second or third one that's been picked up, and I bet you anything, the guys who have been running these Trojans and botnets and everything on Macs are really pissed off at the guy who wrote the one that got them all caught.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure they're all just running just fine under the radar for a while, And then that one got all blown out of proportion in the news, and now everybody's actually looking for them.
Oh, I'm sure they've been around for a while. It's just the joke's always Macs don't get viruses. So,
well, the thing about it is that it's not that they don't get viruses. It's just, again, they're not widely known. However, the Mac system is increasing in sales.
Yes,
for numerous reasons. You know, Jobs is dead.
Wait, that's a reason for selling more Macs is Jobs died?
Absolutely. Some people think that, I guarantee you, there are people out there that think along the lines of, okay, well, you know, I've always thought about it. You know, the man's dead. I want to pay my tribute. And so I'm going to buy a Mac.
Wow.
Me, I guarantee you there are people out there that are that way. The other reason is people, the iPhone. The iPhone is one of the biggest.
Yes, I agree with you there.
Smartphones, okay? So, and this is probably the biggest reason. They're like, oh, well, okay, so they make a good phone. Well, I'm going to go out and buy a computer that's made by Apple, you know? And so the people that are making these Trojans and everything, they're saying that, oh, well, more people are buying them, so we have a larger market to infect.
That's true. And, you know, because the Apple system, the OS X is actually based on Unix, it does have a better architecture as far as security goes. But if you got a dumb user, if you got, you know, exploits, it doesn't help as much as you'd think. So, I mean, it slows you down, but it's, you know, if you've got a Java hole or something, then, well, you've got a Java hole. So,
yep.
All right, last story for tonight is from Gizmodo, and Analog gave me this just before the show, just because it's hilarious. The results of a study conducted by a team from the University of Georgian Medical Center in the Netherlands showed that watching porn will actually turn off part of the brain that processes visual stimuli, at least in women. The study looked at 12 healthy, heterosexual, thank you, Swab, you just screwed me up. Oh, damn it. The study looked at 12 healthy, heterosexual, premenopausal women, all of whom were on hormonal birth control pills. While the researchers looked at their brains using positron electrode PET scans, the women were shown three different films. The first was a control about marine life in the Caribbean. The second two were so-called female-friendly porn. How does it get that classification, I wonder? The results showed that far less blood was sent to the primary visual cortex while the women were watching the most explicit porn. The same thing happens in the brain where a human conducts a non-visual task, like memorizing a list of words, while being shown some sort of visual distractor stimuli. Interestingly, while watching normal non-snuff films, good God, they were showing them snuff films? Extra blood is sent to the visual cortex. One of the members of the research team, urinologist Grint Holseg, hypothesizes that the results indicate the brain is more focused on sexual arousal when watching porn than on actual visual processing of the film. In other words, the porn goes on and the mind goes off, which, that's ended doesn't end well. Whoever wrote that needs to, it's Gizmodo. But yeah, so they've actually proven that people watch porn aren't thinking. They're doing something else.
Well, of course you are. Why else would you be watching porn?
Oh, that's true. Hey, maybe if I turn this porn off, I'd be better reading the news stories tonight.
So,
I have. I've been tripping over myself bad, tell you what.
They didn't do a good enough job with this study. I want to go back, and I will gladly help in the study. They need to hook up some sort of mechanism to their sexual organs. And that way you can tell if blood has been pumping to those organs while the brain has been turned off watching the porn.
Yeah, that might work. I think they were just making that assumption, but yeah.
So. But we can make it a fact. And I have the perfect tool for them to make sure.
Do I even want to know?
Probably not.
All right. Moving on to... Oh, I don't have the sound clip loaded.
Me laugh you long time.
All right. I thought for Digital Dojo tonight, I would do an overview of virtual machines, because we've mentioned them several times in other Digital Dojos. So I thought I would just, you know, describe what they are in case anybody doesn't know. I don't know. It's kind of a basic thing, but yeah, what the hell, right? So there's a couple of different ways to describe what VMs, virtual machines, actually do. They all have essentially two parts. You've got what's called the hypervisor, and you've got the guests or clients. And what they're doing is they are emulating a full computer inside a program. It's actually very similar if you ever play NES or SNES emulators on your computer. It's very similar to that. The SNES emulator is running a program that simulates or emulates what the processor in NES does. That way you can play the game on your computer. So what a virtual machine does is it emulates a full computer in a program. Now, at first that seems kind of silly, but there's actually quite a lot of uses for this. And the other way to describe it is it lets you run multiple operating systems on one computer at the same time. So that's generally your primary... That's generally where you're getting with it. So there's a couple of different kinds of VMs. The big one that most users commonly encounter is desktop virtualization. Generally, the hypervisor is doing the full emulation of a desktop computer, and it's got generic hardware inside the program. Most of the processor instructions are passed directly from the virtual machine onto the CPU, and then when the instructions come back, the hypervisor just passes them right back to the guest. So CPU functions, intensive functions, in a virtual machine are roughly happening at real time. For the most part, the same thing with the disk. It's just passing the command straight onto the real hard disk and pulling them back. Now, it's usually got a wrapper file around it, but you've got the hypervisor in between the virtual machine and the hardware on the machine, but it's really just passing back and forth. It's not doing much of anything. So those aren't too bad on the system resources. The other hardware is emulated. Usually your network video and sound cards are generic devices that are actually being emulated, and the processing of those is happening on your host's CPU. The hypervisor presents a virtual sound card to the operating system that's running in the emulated environment, and it's emulating a chipset, usually like an old Sound Blaster EMU or something like that. And whenever it gets sound from the virtual sound card, it just passes, the hypervisor passes that up to your host OS sound device, and that's how you can hear what it's doing. And as I was saying, a lot of those devices use quite a bit of CPU, especially video, because it's essentially doing all the work translating from the virtual machine to the host machine on the processor. That's why, for example, if you played around with VMware, it's really hard to play 3D games in them. They've gotten better at that, but it's still pretty rough compared to playing them on a direct host. So am I making any sense to you guys? I mean, just being real quiet.
No, it sounds perfectly fine.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
It's just real quiet, so it's like, did I lose the call? Now, the one caveat is that you get an interesting effect of this with USB hardware, because the hypervisor will emulate a USB port for the VM, but all it does is pass directly from a real USB port to the virtual one. So the virtual machine, the operating system inside the virtual machine, can actually control a physical device that's hooked up via USB. So if you want to do true wireless in a virtual machine, USB is the way to go, because if you try to do wireless in a virtual machine and just pass it the network card, it's actually going to emulate a wired card, and it might still send your traffic out over the wireless connection. But as far as the virtual machine is concerned, it's actually a wired connection. So if you're going to be running any tools that need directly access the Wi-Fi chipset, say, for example, Kismet or NetStumbler, you need to use a USB Wi-Fi card. That way the VM gets a real Wi-Fi card.
I did that actually with one... when I had to actually go into the office to work, their network is so it's so much bottlenecked down to where you cannot get out. It sucks. So I ran a VM and basically stuck a Wi-Fi card on it and sent it just to the VM and turned off the wired connection to that computer, to that desktop. And
it worked pretty good, didn't it?
Oh, it worked great. I could get to everything I needed to get to, you know, watch all the videos I wanted. So,
yeah. You know, a lot of the 2D stuff in VMs has gotten pretty good, even though it's still using your CPU to do most of the video work. I do a lot of web browsing in virtual machines just because it's safer, for one thing. But my notes are kind of jumbled up here because I was just kind of hashing them out as I went. Another good use for the desktop virtual machines is to build miniature test environments. Like if you're writing a web page, you could set up a small virtual machine to be your web server and another one to be your database server and actually make a small virtual test environment to develop your web pages in. And it's all still just contained in your computer. It's not actually out on the network, but you can see how your application would perform on this on similar architecture. And the other nice thing with virtual machines is they offer that snapshot feature. And that's where it saves the state of the virtual machine, specifically what's on the hard disk, to out to a file. Now, those snapshots can actually get fairly big. But so you watch disk space usage on those. But on most virtual machines, you can roll back to the snapshot at any time you want. So, for example, I use virtual machines to safely browse the internet. Well, when I'm done browsing the internet, especially if I, you know, hit a page that I think had malware, or if I was trying to collect malware from a page that I know had it, when I'm done, I'll roll back to the snapshot before the malware got on there. That way I know it's clean. You know, you roll it back to a known good state. And it's actually a really damn handy way to make a backup of your system. So before you do something stupid, you snapshot. And then you try it, see if it worked. And then if you broke something, you just roll back to snapshot. I have a lot of virtual machines I use at work that are actually running servers of one form or another. And if I ever need to upgrade a server or make some massive changes to its config, or I just want to try something, I can snapshot it, try whatever it is I want to try, and then when I'm done, roll it back. That way, it's right back to the way it was before I did anything. And if I didn't like what I did, you know, it's not a problem. It's not like on real hardware where if you mess something up, you're reinstalling the operating system and reinstalling all your software and reconfiguring everything. No, you just roll back to snapshot. And that's pretty cool. Now, the other big use of virtual machines is actually, you know, the other kind of virtual machines are what you would call server or enterprise virtual machines. In the VMware line, this would be ESX. So these virtual machines are actually less concerned about presenting a full emulated computer to a guest operating system. Generally, they use what's called para virtualization. Xen and KVM are the big ones there. And para virtualization means it's only partially virtualizing. And the operating system actually has to be, the guest operating system has to be modified so that it knows it's running in a virtual machine. If you ever set up Xen, you have to use kernel patches or kernel modules that tell it it's in Xen. That way, the guest operating system, it knows it's in a virtual machine and it can still function. But these kind of virtual machines are generally faster than the full emulated ones because there's less work that has to be done for the guest operating system to hit the hardware. But the primary use of that kind of virtual machine is for application separation. It's not so much concerned about, you know, presenting this full virtual computer as it is just making separate containers for application 1, application 2, application 3. A lot of data centers do this, especially ones that rent out servers. Amazon's cloud is a good example of this. They can run a smaller number of very powerful computers, and that lets them save a lot on overhead because, you know, if you're running one big computer, you're going to use less electricity, you're going to use less cooling, it takes less physical space than, you know, an equivalent number of physical machines. And it also makes it easier to slice things down. So if you're, say, a data center and you're reselling web hosting, you can resell hosts. You know, you might have one server with 64 gigs of RAM, which in the enterprise virtual environment, that's actually not that weird. I know it sounds a little weird if you're thinking in terms of desktop computers, but you can then slice it down to, you know, small Linux guests, each of them with, say, 512 megs of RAM and half a gig of hard drive space, and sell those out as web hosts. And as long as you're not running anything too crazy intensive, like, you know, just small websites, that'd be fine. That'd do fine. And you can resell them that way for very, very cheap. And a lot of hosting companies do that. Amazon actually charges you for CPU time on their system. They're not, as opposed to a flat fee, it's usage-based. It measures how much RAM and CPU usage your virtual machine pulls, and they bill you for that. So that's kind of an interesting way to go. If your virtual machine isn't doing that much, you can actually save money by running it on Amazon because it's cheaper than the monthly costs of a, you know, full-on virtual host. So, and in the enterprise environment, that snapshotting feature is really handy because if you've got a server that's in use by, you know, an entire company and you need to make a change, you can snapshot beforehand. That way, if the change doesn't work, you know, you're not down the next day. You just roll back to snapshot. And most of the enterprise level hypervisors can actually schedule their snapshots. So they'll do it like once a night. That way you've got a nightly backup, and the snapshotting is generally quicker than, say, a full ghost image or backing up to tape or any of your other more traditional backup methods. I really kind of blazed through that, so did I confuse the hell out of everybody there or what?
What would you say would be the best VM tool right now?
My favorite is virtual. My favorite is VMware. And the reason for that is their entire business model is based on how good their virtualization software is. The other big competitor to VMware on the desktop is VirtualBox. And VirtualBox is free. But ever since Oracle bought all of the Sun properties, I don't think they know what to do with VirtualBox. So it's good as desktop, but it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So enterprise environment, almost every company is using VMware for their virtual machines. Microsoft has a competitor to VMware in both environments, and that's Virtual PC, and I think they're calling it Hyper-V now. And it's actually included in the data center versions. There's a couple of the different versions of the Server 2008. Actually, just have it as a feature. You can turn it on, and Windows will have a virtual machine host in the server built in. So, excuse me just a second. Sorry. Oh, I couldn't hold that one in any longer. In the server environment, it's pretty much the Microsoft Hyper-V or VMware again. And VMware's product is pretty much the industry standard. So that's generally what I use. VirtualBox is good. Hyper-V is also good. I happen to like VMware better. VMware is expensive. They've got free versions of their products. On the desktop side, they've got their VMware Player, which is missing features compared to their full VMware Workstation, or if you're on a Mac, VMware Fusion. But the free player can at least run virtual operating or virtual machines and let you make them. They don't have it does not have the snapshotting feature, and it doesn't have all the networking and disk access features. You can actually, in VMware Workstation, you can actually give it a physical disk and it'll pass it through directly and use it as a hard disk. You know, I haven't played that much with Hyper-V, so I can't really speak to it that much in the server environment. You can actually get a free version of ESX, which is VMware's enterprise virtual machine hosting. And the idea is obviously you use the free stuff, and then when you want to go to the next level, you go buy their product. VMware is expensive, though. VMware Workstation is like a $200 piece of software. VirtualBox is free. So for a lot of people, VirtualBox wins that argument. in the enterprise side, Xen and KVM are your Linux enterprise level hosting. And a lot of people actually use KVM as desktop virtual machines as well. Those are both the Para virtualization, which means you need a guest that can be installed in a virtual machine. Most any of your Linux distros can be patched to do it. Several of the BSDs. There was a project to run Windows on KVM and Xen, using patched drivers. I don't honestly know how far that got. I haven't been following it that well. There's another version. Parallels. I'm looking at my link list now, because all I've got for Digital Dojo and links is just links to all the different virtual machines the big ones that are out there. There's tons of little ones too, but I haven't even mentioned QMU, which is the open source one, which a lot of people don't use because it's slow, but it's actually really good because you can use QMU to emulate different types of processors. Like I know a lot of people do Android development on QMU and PowerPC. And some of the older chips on QMU. So, but yeah, your big ones are VMware, VirtualBox, VirtualPC, Zen, KVM, and Parallels. So, in case I haven't mentioned them, that's the list. So, anybody got anything else on that before we move on there? Because I know I kind of blazed right through that, and I was just trying to describe it all kind of as an overview.
Sounds pretty good.
Okay. So, all right. Well, just to close things out here, of course, always, as always, listen to the stream. We're constantly updating it. We're always looking for new music. Sard's done work on the stream. RU and Tack have done some work on the stream. So definitely worth your time to listen to it. I listen to it in the background at work. So it's helpful. Of course, I have nothing every Saturday. I will not be on IHN this weekend. I have to go help the parents with some stuff. So I will be out of town. Pure Decking every Thursday. Between the Sheets is currently on hiatus. NR7, whenever I think we're going to...
I feel like it.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. Whenever BSV gets done harassing the aliens. Of course, always follow the Galaxy 15 Radio Twitter handle. It'll tell you whenever we update the Galaxy 15 Radio site. Galaxy15radio.com. Use the feedback forms. We like feedback. So, even if it's just to make fun of me, because Analog loves having ammo. So
it's not that hard.
Yeah, it's especially after tonight. Holy crap. That's pretty much all I got. Anybody got anything?
Peace.